I'm Lori McCandish King, reporting from Corte Madera, California. I'm talking today with Cameron Hewitt, author of The Temporary European, Lessons and Confessions of a Professional Traveler. Cameron has been Rick Steves' right-hand person for a couple of decades now, and I would wager to say he knows everything there is to know about traveling and about travel writing, and I am so excited to be talking to you today, Cameron. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You have just come back from a trip to Europe. This is sort of post-COVID, not exactly. And you typically spend, for Rick Steves Europe, typically spend, say, 100 days, did you say, a year in Europe? What was it like to go back after, you know, it feels like home, probably, and yet you weren't able to travel for a while. What was it like to go back?
That's right. And that's why the book is called Temporary European. I feel like 100 days a year over 20 years. I think I've figured out once I've spent 5 years of my life in Europe, but not all at once, kind of spread out over 20 years. And it was hard for 2 years, unplanned hiatus from travel, didn't set foot in Europe for 2 years. And so we're back at it now. Things are starting to come back. Like you said, it's not exactly post-COVID, but it's learning to live with COVID, I guess. And I was just in Rome and in London for a couple weeks each, updating their Rick Steves guidebooks for the first time in person after an unplanned two-year hiatus. And man, it felt great. I brought a whole new appreciation for the privilege of travel. It just being not able to travel reminded me how special it is that we get to go and have these experiences.
Yeah, it is special. I've been in the travel world a bit, and my big question for you was about your local tour guides and how they've been managing. Tell us, how are they faring?
You know, they're making a go of it like anybody. They're figuring it out. So, you know, we have tours in Europe for Rick Steves Europe, and there's about 150 freelance tour guides who work with us. Most of them are based in Europe. And it was a tough time. I mean, these are people, I'm thinking of a couple I know in Slovenia, and they're a husband and wife team, and they're both tour guides. And so the entire family's income comes from tourism. And, you know, as a case study, like they're wonderful people. They're so enthusiastic about Slovenia. They love to teach, and they couldn't do it. So I remember one of them, I think, actually had a friend who had an apple orchard. So he went and worked at the harvest at the apple orchard for a few months just to make ends meet. And in Europe, a lot of governments gave a lot of generous subsidies to people in that situation. But it was still a tough time. A lot of our guides had to find other jobs. Hopefully, temporarily, they were all just dying to get back on our buses and leading our tours. A few of them decided this new job, maybe they're ready to leave the tour guiding lifestyle behind and they've decided to stay at their new job. But others are back on the buses. And when you go back there, they just explode with enthusiasm when they see us. People like me, people from the Rick Steves office. These are our good friends that we haven't seen for 2 years. So to be able to go back and spend time with them is really, really special.
You've done pretty much everything there is to do at the organization you're at. So you have done research, you've been a guide, you've done some of the TV shows, audio, video. What do you like the most and why?
Yeah, it's a small company, and I started 22 years ago. It was even smaller, and we've always had this philosophy of everyone multitasks and lots of opportunities to try different things. I'd spent most of my time working on our travel guidebooks, updating old guidebooks, researching and writing new guidebooks. And in fact, I kind of retired from tour guiding a few years ago because I just felt pulled in too many directions. I think that's my favorite for sure. I love the independence of it. It's a lot of work, a tremendous amount of work, but I get to set my own schedule. I get to figure out how I want to fit in all that work. It gives me opportunities to kind of slow down if I feel like it and relax and linger and enjoy a little bit. And it really puts me in contact with so many interesting Europeans, whether it's people who run our hotels that we recommend in our books, or restaurants, or local tour guides. All day long, I'm reuniting with old friends or meeting new strangers. Most of the interactions go great. Some of them don't. That's part of the job. But I think I just love the way that just gives me a chance to really have an experience with all facets of a place.
There's a part in your book that I like. It's a little bit voyeuristic. The part that goes, I've been inside your hotel room. Would you read that?
Yes. Okay, here we are. This is from a chapter called A Day in the Life of a Guidebook Researcher. And it's an aspect of my work updating our guidebooks that maybe people haven't thought of before. I've been in your hotel room. While you were out sightseeing, the receptionist let me in. I saw which guidebooks and brochures you had on the desk. I saw that you left the air conditioning on full blast. I saw the mess, or the lack of a mess. Some of you arrange your toiletries by size next to the sink and organize your bedside reading into a neat stack. Most of you leave the room looking like a dirty bomb exploded inside your suitcase. I'm not snooping for a perverse thrill. I'm inspecting your hotel to make sure it's as we describe it in our guidebook. Is it still nicely appointed and well-maintained? Is it a bit dumpy, or can it be upgraded to sharp? There's only one way to find out. I have seen thousands upon thousands of hotel rooms all across Europe. Most are freshly cleaned and ready for check-in. Quite a few I visit during that odoriferous window between checkout and cleaning, when bedclothes are strewn about, a nighttime's worth of garlic breath and stale farts mingle in the humid air, and the toilet bowl is in a state that might cause a veteran housekeeper to retire on the spot. And some of the rooms are currently occupied, but the occupants have stepped out. I respect a hotelier who says, "Sorry, we cannot show you a guest room." But if I'm being honest, I get a kick out of the ones that just don't care. They walk down the hall, lightly knocking and then throwing open each door. And sometimes, while I'm judging someone's choice of toothpaste or deodorant, or marveling at how many different surfaces upon which travelers can drape wet laundry to dry, or appreciating how Germans all seem to fold their pajamas neatly on the pillow, surely this must be taught in schools, I think about how surreal it is to write a guidebook, and also how much less glamorous it is than everyone thinks.
I especially like the part about Germans folding their pajamas on the pillow. I don't know why it is that. It's just so fun to hear about other nationalities in that way. And sometimes that turns into a little bit of a cliche. And you've done a lot of thinking about travel and cliches of people of different nationalities. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've got several chapters in my book that really talk about that. And it's complicated because there are different national identities and cultures, right? It's very easy to reduce those to cliches and stereotypes. And yet a lot of times there's a kernel of truth to that. So when I'm doing a guidebook, I try to be very mindful of that. I want to find details that give people insight into the culture, something genuine about the culture, but to be careful to stop just shy of wallowing in sort of cliches and stereotypes. What I like to do is take a stereotype or a cliche and use it as sort of a launching off point for investigating a little bit more deeply to kind of probe beyond the superficial part of the cliche. So for instance, I have a chapter in my book about traveling in Scotland. I was working on a new travel guidebook in Scotland. And man, in the really touristy towns in Scotland, there's just so much cliche. It's tartans everywhere and bagpipes. And you start to get kind of numb to it and you start feeling like this is all just marketing. It's all, you know, this can't be real. And I tell the story in the book about how I went to this beautiful small town Highland Games in this little village no one's ever heard of. I just happened to be in town that day. And man, it was beautiful because I was one of the only tourists and I could tell that this was really something that they were doing for their own community. Everyone seemed to know each other. It was very kind of endearingly small town and kind of hokey, but there was just an authenticity to it that I loved. And I thought a whole different way after that about some of these cliches. And I thought about why it is that, you know, Scottish people wear kilts and play bagpipes. Like suddenly those weren't just stereotypes. They were a part of a treasured cultural identity.
Talk a little bit about that identity and what does it tell us about the people of Scotland? Like the part about the kilts being the same color for a particular reason and the reason behind the bagpipes.
Right. Well, the kilts, when you're in Edinburgh, for example, there's all these gift shops and you can kind of give them your family name or a family name you like, and they'll give you your official kilt. And they're all very carefully regimented in very bright colors. And that was all standardized during the Victorian age. So that's not a deep tradition. However, when you kind of dig a little bit deeper, what you learn is different clans would live in the same area, of course. So they had access to the same natural dyes. So naturally, people in the same clan would dress in similar colors. So there actually is kind of an authentic piece of history behind what sort of over time has evolved into something that might seem like a cliche. I mean, another example, a great feature of the Highland Games is hill racing. They have, you know, people running around that racetrack. And at one point, this was just such a fun moment. They started the hill race and these runners did a lap and then they exited the fairgrounds. And then a couple minutes later, you could see them bobbing up the slope of a nearby hill. So they go up to the summit, and then an hour later, like, we'd all forgotten about them, and suddenly these runners come back in, and you think, well, that's kind of funny, but then you think, well, yes, that's a very important skill to have. Back in traditional Highland life, you had to be able to traverse long distances. You had to be able to quickly cross hills and go over the summits of mountains to get to the neighboring community. So it was really fun to kind of watch all that stuff in context and think about where it came from.
You had some interesting observations also about food and culture. Talk to us about that.
Boy, I don't know where to begin. It's interesting in the book I talk about the word foodie, and like there are people who think that's just a silly word, and there's people who embrace it. And I've decided I'm going to take foodie back, and it just means somebody who loves food and prioritizes food in their travels. And boy, a lot of my stories, a surprising number of my stories when I look back at it, kind of use food as an in to understanding a culture. So for instance, in Sicily, Palermo, I have a chapter about a street food tour. So I went around with a local guide and he took me to try different street foods. And what was fascinating is with each food, whether it was a arancini or a cannoli or a spleen sandwich, he would kind of explain it in a way that it taught you something about the climate and the terrain and the history and just the personality of Sicily. And each item had a story to tell. And some of them were things I never would normally taste in my everyday life. But that's what I love about travel. It pulls you out of your comfort zone. You try new things. And while you're at it, you kind of come away not just with a good meal, but with new insights about a place.
And the spleen sandwich?
The spleen?
How was it?
It was fine. People love it. I described, someone said, the guide told me it was going to be a little bit like liver, but gamier. And I thought that was a good, I'm not a fan of organ meat. I also have a philosophy when I'm traveling, I will try any food once. If I don't like it, I don't have to have it again. But yeah, it was an experience.
I did that with haggis. It was actually pretty good though. I liked it. I would love to hear your Swiss Alps story.
Yeah, this is an excerpt from a chapter called Making Hay While the Sun Shines. And it tells the story of I was in the Swiss Alps in the Lauterbrunnen Valley near Interlaken. I was updating our Rick Steves guidebook. And it was early to mid-September. And I rode the funicular up in order to update our information. And I realized, oh my goodness, it's a beautiful day. I have a couple hours. Here's a hike that's described in the book that I just, on the spur of the moment, I said, I'm going to take this hike. And I learned the meaning of the phrase making hay while the sun shines because I was there just as the summer season was winding down. So here's an excerpt from the book describing that walk. Crossing the alpine meadow at what feels like the top of the world, I make my way down to a gathering of huts called Schiltalp. Summer is nearly over, and very soon the cowhands will strap big ceremonial bells around the cows' necks, bedeck them with wildflowers, and parade them back down through the village to their barns for the winter. You never know exactly when the cows will come down. It's dictated by the weather. But I was lucky enough to see this spectacle years ago, and it remains one of my all-time favorite Swiss memories. An impromptu folk life parade where the bovine grand marshals were cheered like returning war heroes. Schiltalp's biggest hut has a self-service fridge where hikers can buy a drink or a wedge of alpine cheese. The outdoor tables are enjoying some late afternoon sun, and the only people sitting there are four rough and grizzled locals nursing beers, giving me suspicious looks. Clearly, I've crashed a local party. To break the tension, I attempt the local Swiss-German greeting. After more than 20 years of traveling in Switzerland, I am still trying to master it. Grüezi? In Swiss cities, that does the trick. But in the countryside, sing-songy Swiss-German grows sing-songier. And up here, each village, even each farmhouse, gives the phrase its own color. As usual, the four old-timers respond with four entirely different ways of saying the same word. Grüezi, Grüße, Grüezi, Grüezi. They return to their beers, making it clear our conversation is now complete. I drop a few coins in the jar and help myself to a wedge of mountain cheese. It has a pungent aroma, but it's still soft, not quite fresh, not quite aged, and speckled with tiny bubbles. I saw a small chunk off the slab, mounted on a skinny slice of full-grain bread, and take a bite. The texture is smooth and creamy. The flavor is sharp and searing, filling my mouth with the taste of hay and wildflowers and a tannic kick and deep, deep Swiss tradition. It marries perfectly with the aroma of fresh-cut hay and day-old manure. It's easily the best cheese of my trip, if not my life. Recharged, I bid the gang a cheery adieu, that one's easy, and head down the path. Within moments, I'm immersed in a Hills Are Alive landscape of grassy slopes, wooden barns, and mooing cows. And then, in the distance, I hear cowhands hooting and whistling. The mooing becomes more agitated. The cows are on the move. The cowhands crest the hill and come into view. It's a family, dad, mom, and a couple of kids, working together to drive their herd in for the night. They're dressed in shorts, t-shirts, and trucker hats, but they enact a timeless ritual of human and beast. Moving a fleet of giant animals, many times their own size, armed only with insistent yelps and a big stick. And then I'm surrounded. Cows are on all sides of me. Cowhands behind them, driving them up the gravel road I'm standing on. A bit frightened by the thousands of pounds of impatient beef plodding my way, I stand still, a rock in a stream of livestock. Once the cows have passed, I carry on down the path, leaving the slow-motion stampede behind me. I am buzzing from the moment I just experienced. one of those beautiful serendipities where it feels like every decision I made today conspired to put me in the perfect place at the perfect time. And I'll just follow up. You're asking about how food gives you an insight to culture. Earlier in the chapter, I talk about how the Swiss government actually subsidizes these farm operations, these cheese-making operations in rustic huts, where basically every summer they bring the cows up from the villages in the valley below, and someone has to live with them up there for 100 days, basically, through the summer, and will rise early every morning to milk them and milk them again in the afternoon, and then they have to make the cheese right there. It's a very rustic, traditional way of doing things, but the Swiss taxpayers happily subsidize that. They know that their money is going to this. They think it's wonderful because, of course, when you think of Switzerland, what do you think of? Cheese, Swiss cheese, right?
You know, in the story about Switzerland, I think part of the reason that worked for you was, of course, because of your attitude. And attitude is so important when we travel. It helps us connect with other people. I love the European characters in your book, but I was really inspired by your wife's great Aunt Mildred. I had a great Aunt Edna who was similar, a world traveler when I was a kid. And I bet, like you said, a lot of people have a great aunt whoever like this. Tell us a little bit about great Aunt Mildred and what you learned from her.
Yes. So Mildred Scott, she was an amazing woman. And she was a retired school teacher in her late 50s, early 60s. And she had not traveled much. She actually had been in poor health when she was younger. So she'd been abroad once and never again. And she came into an inheritance. And she said, you know what? I'm going to use this money to see the world. And so starting around the age of 60, Aunt Mildred decided she wanted to touch down in every continent and most of the countries on Earth. And she did. She actually wrote a memoir about it later. Actually, I read through the memoir for inspiration while I was writing my travel memoir. And it's just amazing. I mean, think about it. In the 1950s, 1960s, here's this unmarried woman, retired school teacher, at a time when traveling on your own in that situation was probably not particularly, quote, normal. But man, she just had a wonderful experience, and she told all these great tales. Now, the title of the book is something that inspires me. After seeing so much of the world, the thing that she took away was, jams are fun. That's the title of the book. And the idea is that, you know, you don't really remember all the big fancy sights after your trip. What you remember are those beautiful little moments in between, and especially you remember the things that go wrong on your trip. And so I think Mildred sort of taught me that when trips go sideways, that's when things are getting good.
Cameron, read us a little bit from your book, The Jams Are Fun part. One of the jams are fun. There are a bunch of them in there, but this is one of them.
Yeah, you bet. So this is how I introduced the concept of jams are fun. And it starts with an anecdote, as with everything in the book, this actually happened to be, that kind of illustrates this. On the express train from Warsaw to Krakow, I shared a compartment with two middle-aged American couples. They were weary and flustered, having rushed to get on the train just before it pulled out. As they settled in, I remarked how light they were packing. Each one had only a small day bag. Oh, we use the luggage check service, they said. The luggage check service? I had never heard of such a thing. Either I was about to get a great tip from my book, or they had made a terrible mistake. Yeah, you know, that desk where you give them your bags and you tell them which train you're taking, and they deliver them to you at the other end. My heart sank. They looked so exhausted, yet happy. They had dived into Poland headfirst and were making a go of it. And we were just a few minutes into a nonstop 3-hour train ride. But they deserved to know. Gently as I could, I explained that the service they had availed themselves of was a left luggage desk. When they got to Krakow, their bags would be waiting for them, back in Warsaw. They took the news admirably and spent the rest of the trip debating who would be heading back to Warsaw that evening. While that was a very long day for one of them, I like to imagine that this has become one of their favorite travel tales, told with relish anytime someone broaches the topic of good trips gone bad. In other words, it was a classic example of my travel motto, jams are fun. My wife's great-great-aunt Mildred was a remarkable soul. Around age 60, when most of her peers were gardening or singing in the church choir, Mildred Scott began traveling. Back in the 1950s, such a thing was unheard of for an unmarried woman. No matter. Over the next 15 years, Mildred spent month after month on the road, visiting every continent on Earth. And in her final years, after seeing more of our planet than everyone else in her Ohio hometown combined, she penned a travelogue. The title? Jams Are Fun. After all those adventures, what stuck with Mildred wasn't the castles and the cathedrals, it wasn't the museums and the monuments, and it wasn't the grand spectacles or the gourmet meals. It was those times when she paused to reflect on where she was without an agenda. It was the people she crossed paths with, both locals and fellow travelers who made an impression. And most of all, it was those moments when trips went sideways, memorable snags and perfectly laid plans that forced her to scramble for creative solutions or simply accept whatever life presented her with.
I love that story. And all the stories in your book, they've really made me feel like getting out there again and going. Itchy feet. I really want to go. And thank you for spurring me in that direction. I've been talking with Cameron Hewitt, author of The Temporary European, Lessons and Confessions of a Professional Traveler. Thank you so much, Cameron.
Great. Thank you for having me. And for all of you finally heading back to Europe or wherever you're going, happy travels this year.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.